You're tuned into Radio EFF, Radio Free Cyberspace.
The Patriot Act gives the U.S. government sweeping new powers in both the areas of domestic law enforcement and foreign counterintelligence surveillance. It eliminates many of the checks and balances that had given courts an opportunity to prevent abuse of these powers. I want to start off in talking about the Patriot Act by reviewing a little bit of the history and why it is that EFF and many other civil liberties groups were very, very concerned about expanding these kinds of surveillance powers. We have to remember, first of all, that many of the checks and balances we see or did see in the law were added because we discovered that there were many abuses of these powers by the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA. And it is part of the problem here that we seem to forget history whenever a crisis comes up and therefore rush to give powers to the government that it's not clear they needed. Here are some examples of past executive branch abuse of surveillance powers. Between 1960 and 1974, the FBI kept files on 1 million Americans and investigated 500,000 so-called subversives, but there wasn't a single court conviction. The CIA, with the help of the post office, illegally opened the mail for more than 20 years, collecting information on 1.5 million Americans, from writers like John Steinbeck to politicians like Hubert Humphrey and even Richard Nixon. Between 1947 and 1975, the National Security Agency intercepted every single overseas telegram sent or received by an American citizen. And when, during congressional hearings, an NSA official was asked whether he was concerned about the legality of those actions, he simply said, "We didn't consider it at the time, no." The IRS gave the FBI the tax returns of 11,000 groups and individuals and used its audit powers as a form of political harassment. These are just a few of the many examples of executive branch surveillance abuse that were revealed during the Church Committee hearings. As a result of the Church Committee hearings, it was concluded by many in government that the only way to have a constitutional and legitimate program of surveillance was for it to be held under tremendous judicial oversight and accountability. A basic problem with Patriot is that we have ignored that lesson. But what about the process by which Patriot was enacted? Well, let's remember that the act is very big and very complicated. When we printed it out, it was 342 pages. It makes changes, many significant, to at least 15 statutory regimes. And when I say statutory regimes, I don't mean code sections. You know, it is entire huge segments of the United States Code that had been changed by this bill. It's highly unlikely, given the speed with which this bill was passed, that any of the congressmen or senators actually read the bill and actually understood in full what it does. How could they? When we have analyzed this bill, we have had to go back and forth and back and forth for hours at a time between the text of the bill and the text of the laws that it changes in order to figure out what it does. And that's only a start, because in order to really understand what a law does, you have to also know all the cases that interpreted it. in the month or so that it took to pass this bill, there was no way that these representatives could have understood it. Nor did they take any kind of reasonable testimony about this bill. Considering how much they've expanded surveillance powers, you would think that they would have held hearings, listened to civil liberties groups, listened to people who have been victims of surveillance in the past, asked the Justice Department to come back and explain why these powers, without any kind of meaningful oversight, needed to be expanded, and how they related to the events of September 11th. Would they have made a difference? None of this was ever brought before Congress. None of this entered the public debate. And in fact, during the period that the bill was being put together, much of the proceedings were secret. There were many days where we would be hearing from reporters that, oh, the Judiciary Committee is going to do this, or the Judiciary Committee says that it's going to put in this new safeguard. What do you think? And our answer would always be, well, until we see the legislative language, there's no way we can comment. But we couldn't see it because the bill was never actually introduced until very, very late in the game, after all the negotiations and all the compromises pretty much had been made. That's not a process that inspires a great deal of faith or confidence in public discourse. And now I want to turn to the two main substantive concerns that EFF has with the Patriot Act as it ended up being enacted. There are two sort of overarching bullet points, you might say, about the bill. The first is that it generally expands surveillance powers and at the same time reduces accountability. In lay terms, it's going to be easier for the government to spy on people. The other big substantive issue here is that it not only changes what we normally think of as surveillance in order to uncover criminality, but it also enhances the government's power under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is intended to allow the government to conduct surveillance in order to combat espionage or other kinds of possibly hostile foreign activity within the United States. Let me start with the law enforcement surveillance side, and after hitting a few big points there, go on to foreign intelligence surveillance. Now, on the law enforcement surveillance side, the big issue is that it reduces judicial oversight. You have to remember that in the area of surveillance, there are four basic kinds of mechanisms. The first is a wiretap order or an interception order. And this is the hardest to get. You have to get it from a judge. You have to show lots of facts. And at the end of the day, when the wiretapping is done, then you have to report back to the court. The second major kind of surveillance instrument is the ordinary search warrant. An ordinary search warrant, like a wiretap order, requires probable cause of criminality, but it doesn't have quite as many restrictions on it as an interception order. Then you get into these two lesser areas of surveillance, but they become increasingly important in a networked world. On the one hand, you have subpoenas, which are often issued without any kind of court intervention at all. And what subpoenas do is they're served on somebody, and then that person is compelled to produce certain kinds of records, documents, or other tangible things. In the online context, subpoenas are often used to get records from ISPs about what their customers' communications involve, transaction, billing records, subscriber identity, all that sort of stuff. While it's easy to get a subpoena issued, one big counterweight is that normally the person who is the target of a subpoena has an opportunity to challenge it before he or she actually has records produced. That's called a motion to quash. The last major instrument of surveillance, or perhaps more accurately, information gathering, is a pen register trap and trace device order. This is a very, very easy to get kind of court order that allows law enforcement to find out what telephone numbers were dialed by you or dialed to you. At least prior to Patriot, it was about telephone numbers. After Patriot, it's very clear that the pen register trap and trace device authority extends to all forms of electronic communications as well. Now, in this list of four major surveillance instruments, I would have to say that the biggest change in power wrought by the Patriot Act is with respect to pen trap devices, and that's what I think I'll focus on. First big point about the pen trap amendment is that, unlike many other provisions of the bill, it doesn't sunset or expire. You probably remember that during the debate over the Patriot Act, there was enough of a concern over its civil liberties implications that the House said, well, we're going to put something in so that regardless of what we do, it won't be permanent. That was a laudable attempt to try to compensate for the fact they didn't have any sort of desire or inclination to really study the provisions of the bill. It's not a substitute for reasoned deliberation, but I suppose that if you've got to do something, at least having the provisions sunset before they can do additional damage is better than nothing. Unfortunately, not all of the provisions do sunset, and some of the most important provisions are the ones that don't. The first major example is, as I mentioned, the pen trap amendments. Now, you have to remember that the whole idea of a pen register or a trap and trace device is an ancient telephony example. Back in the 1960s and 70s, when the Supreme Court ruled that it was okay to use pen trap devices without running into the Fourth Amendment's provisions, they were ruling on an extremely primitive device. Back in the days of wires, you would have a device attached, physically attached, to the telephone line at the central office, and it would simply pick up mechanically or electronically, really electrically, the impulses that were dialed on that phone line, and it would scratch them out on a piece of paper tape. And so when someone dialed the number, the pen register would also register on this paper tape what they dialed. Now, the reason why I say this is really primitive is because all it told you was what numbers were dialed. It wouldn't tell you anything about whether the call was even completed. It wouldn't tell you if there was a busy signal or no answer at the other end. It wouldn't tell you anything about how long the call lasted. It only told you about what numbers were dialed. Also to remember is that in those days, there was a very clear separation between the telephone numbers dialed and the telephone call itself. It was physically impossible for the pen register device, even though it was attached to the telephone line, to pick up anything about the conversation itself. It just couldn't do that. And it was that kind of pen register or trap and trace device that the Supreme Court found didn't infringe upon the Fourth Amendment because it was so limited in its capacities. Well, that was a long time ago, even in real years. If you fast forward into the world of internet electronic communications, and then discovered that, well, Congress just rewrote the pen trap statute so that it would apply to packet or internet communications. And if you know anything about how the internet works, your first question would be, well, how exactly could they do that? Because there is nothing in the internet world, in the TCP/IP protocol, that really maps directly to a telephone number. And there isn't really anything in the internet world that maps to this hermetic separation between the telephone number and the contents of the conversation. In reality, every TCP/IP packet contains both addressing information and content information. And while sometimes we think of the packets that travel over the internet as being like onions or concentric spheres, so that you can look at the outside and not look at the inside, that's not actually true. From a real world standpoint, all the information in a packet is essentially like a postcard. It's all on the outside. The trick is that the software that processes the protocol is willfully blind to different parts of it. So when SMTP is doing something with your email, it only looks at some of that packet. And when the POP server and the POP protocol are working, they're only looking at parts of the packet. But there are tools like packet sniffers that can look at everything on the packet. And so when we begin to ask ourselves, well, how would law enforcement do a pen register or do a trap and trace device on the internet and only get the, quote, telephone number, unquote, you begin to see that that's a very, very weaselly sort of proposition, because unlike the pen register of the old days, they really do have access to the contents as well as to the number. Now, compounding all this is that we don't think, or at least we have no reason to think, that Congress really understood what it was doing when it updated the pen trap statute to include electronic communications. What they did is they took a statute that spoke in terms of dialed numbers and impulses and attachments to telephone lines, and they expanded the notion to that of dialing, routing, addressing, and signaling information on a communications channel or device. And then they added, but not to include the contents of any such communication. Well, that sounds fine and dandy until you realize that they didn't define dialing, routing, addressing, or signaling information, and they didn't define contents. And this creates a big problem for internet communications. The easiest example to think of is web surfing, because any kind of web browsing counts as an electronic communication as far as the law is concerned. Now let's compare what the government would get if they had a pen trap order and monitored your telephone calling versus if they had a pen trap order and monitored your internet connection. Let's suppose you're a journalist and you call me at the EFF to ask me about the Patriot Act. What they will know is they will know that you called me, but they won't know anything about what we talked about. They might guess what we were talking about, but they wouldn't know. Well, what if you as a journalist, instead of talking to me, decide, well, I'll just surf over to the EFF website and start looking at what they have on the Patriot Act. And you would successively, URL after URL, go to our site and go to the individual pages where we have published our analysis of the Patriot Act and various other backgrounders. Well, what they will get or what they could get, because we don't know what the courts are going to say dialing, routing, and addressing and signaling information means. But I can well imagine a court saying, well, they got all these web addresses, that's fine. That's what the statute says they can get. And, well, the web address might say something like patriot.bill.txt, but that's not very revealing, so we're not going to worry about it. But what did they really get? They really know what you looked at, because all they have to do is to go to the same address and find out what's on that page. And so, depending on how the courts construe this, and we're not optimistic, what they may be able to get with a pen trap order is much more like the equivalent of library book borrowing records, video rental records, bookstore buying records, a really good and detailed account of what one is actually reading on the internet. And that is so far beyond what they could have gotten in the old days with just telephone numbers dialed to and from your device, that we think it's an abomination that this sort of possibility exists under the law. Because you have to remember, the big difference between pen trap and other kinds of wiretaps or interception orders was always the idea that they weren't going to get content this way. And if the law is interpreted in the way that we're afraid it might be, they will be getting content. And so that's the first major, huge problem with the Patriot Act. And just to top it off, remember that with a pen trap order, they never have to report back to the judge with anything about the fruits of the surveillance. There is one exception. If the government uses its own packet sniffer, what people have called, what the FBI called carnivore, then there has to be an audit trail. They will have to report to the court who was doing the surveillance, how the machine was configured, and they'll even have to provide a copy of all the information that was collected. It's not clear, however, what any of those terms specifically means, because they didn't define what the information collected means. Remember that when carnivore was first announced, one of the big concerns was that they would put this device on a network branch, and supposedly it would filter so that it only captured packets pertaining to the target of surveillance. But it's sitting there on the entire pipe, and we have no way of knowing what exactly it's capturing. Remember also that in order to even decide whether or not a packet is a packet addressed to you or me or someone else, it still has to look at it. And in the computer world, that means making a copy of the packet, at least, if nowhere else, in the buffer RAM of the machine. It's an interesting question, then, exactly what the statute covers when they say all the information collected. Because one could ask, well, did that mean include the information that they threw away? We just don't know. There isn't enough information about that. There are a couple other major points here about law enforcement surveillance, but I'm going to touch on them very, very briefly. And these are things that do not sunset. They do not expire. Probably the most important is that they've now increased the role of so-called sneak and peek search warrants. That means a search warrant that gets executed, but you don't know about it. It used to be a lot harder to get a sneak and peek warrant. Now it's a lot easier, and we're very concerned that this is unconstitutional. In fact, if we ever do get a chance to challenge the Patriot Act, that's probably one of the first things we'll say is unconstitutional, because the Supreme Court has said several times that notice to the target of a search warrant is an important component of Fourth Amendment reasonableness. Now I'm going to move on to the question of foreign intelligence surveillance, and which is something that a lot of people don't know much about. Remember that I said that there were these four general mechanisms for doing surveillance: wiretaps, search warrants, subpoenas, pen trap orders. And I talked about probable cause and other kinds of standards. The thing to remember is that each of these surveillance tools is available on the foreign intelligence surveillance side when they're looking for agents of foreign powers and not for criminality. But the standard is much different. Because the aim of foreign intelligence surveillance is not to get a prosecution, not to put someone away, rather to figure out what's going on, the bar is considerably lower. All the basic trigger for foreign intelligence surveillance is the notion that someone is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. Now, obviously, a foreign government is a foreign power. If you're an employee of a foreign government, it's very easy to be an agent of a foreign power. So, for instance, a Spanish national working for the Spanish consulate in the United States is an agent of a foreign power. But there are a lot of less clear definitions of a foreign power and agents of a foreign power. Groups or factions or political parties that the government believes are controlled by a foreign government, those can qualify as foreign powers. A foreign-based political organization substantially composed of non-U.S. persons qualifies as a foreign power. You belong to them, you and you're a foreign national, you could be an agent of a foreign power. And all they need, basically, to get a FISA order for surveillance is probable cause to believe that you're an agent of a foreign power. Now, if you're a U.S. person, it's a little harder. Normally, if you're a U.S. person, then those Fourth Amendment protections apply to some extent, and they have to have probable cause to believe that not only that you're an agent of a foreign power, but that you're doing something that involves or relates to criminality. But here comes the second big kicker with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that is that none of its proceedings are in the slightest bit public. There's a secret court in Washington, D.C. that processes all of these foreign intelligence surveillance applications. In the 23 years of its existence, we know of only one time that it has ever denied an application. The proceedings before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court are quite secret. They're one-sided. The Justice Department makes its presentation, and the court decides. And not only that, the court is pretty much, rubber stamp is probably too strong, but it doesn't have a lot of discretion. You know, normally, if a law enforcement officer goes to a judge and applies for a search warrant, the judge takes a pretty careful look, or at least he can take a pretty careful look at the application and say, well, wait a minute, you didn't spell this out, you didn't spell that out, come back to me with a better application. And that's the way it should be. That gives the judiciary a real role in overseeing surveillance. That's not the way it is with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. The basic job of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is to make sure that all the boxes have been checked, that the proper certifications or statements of belief have been made. But it is not that court's role to second-guess the truth or sincerity of any of those statements. If they're there, that's enough. So there isn't much judicial oversight, although there is some. with respect to FISA orders. And the only time that anyone ever has a chance, and it's not a very good chance, to challenge a FISA order is if, after the FISA surveillance, the fruits of that surveillance are actually used in a criminal proceeding against someone. Then that person can say, wait a minute, I want to move to suppress that evidence because I think they got it in an unlawful way. And then they would be able to litigate whether or not the FISA surveillance was legal and whether or not the evidence should be used. But even there, they would be handicapped because they probably wouldn't be able to see the application or any of the underlying facts, because that itself would be held secret. And second, the district court that's reviewing the motion to suppress has to use the same standards that the FISA court did, which means that it's not its job to second guess the truth or sincerity of any of the statements in the application. So there's oversight, but it's pretty minimal. Now, having explained why FISA surveillance is something to be concerned about, what have they done? Well, the biggest thing that they did to expand FISA surveillance, it's really to take away the whole notion that FISA surveillance is for a foreign intelligence purpose. Ever since the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act came into being, everyone recognized that because the standards were so much lower for foreign intelligence surveillance, you had to keep a kind of wall of separation between ordinary law enforcement surveillance and foreign intelligence surveillance. The leeway that the government gets in foreign intelligence surveillance is partly because it's mostly aimed at non-US persons, and partly because it's not as likely that any of that will be used to put someone away in jail. Unfortunately, that has changed. The Patriot Act no longer requires that, means that the FISA no longer requires that the primary purpose of the surveillance be for foreign intelligence gathering. It has changed that so that it only needs to be a significant purpose. Now, to a layperson, that may not sound like much of a difference, but in the legal world, it's an enormous difference, because they could have a significant purpose of gathering foreign intelligence and at the same time have their primary purpose be to obtain evidence of a crime. Whereas under the previous formulation, they could only have a primary purpose of gathering foreign intelligence. The criminal aspect of it had to be almost incidental or an afterthought. And this was made clear in a case where someone did challenge foreign intelligence surveillance, and the court ended up finding that while the surveillance began with the primary purpose of gathering foreign intelligence, along the way, when they realized they weren't really getting much foreign intelligence, but they were learning about crimes, that the purpose of the surveillance has shifted so that the primary purpose was now law enforcement. And the court said, that's great, but you cannot use that evidence after that point in this criminal trial. That case would not be decided the same way today because of the Patriot Act. So this simple change from primary to significant means that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is a much more significant tool for getting evidence of criminality, even though that's not what it was intended to do. The second and last major change in that the Patriot Act causes for foreign intelligence surveillance that I'm going to talk about is the inclusion of roving wiretap power to Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Now, what is a roving wiretap? An ordinary wiretap is something that you put on a particular communications device or line. So you would apply for the wiretap and say, well, I want to tap the phone at in this house with this phone number, and I want to tap this phone, and I want to tap that phone. The basic idea is you have to list with particularity the devices you intend to tap. A roving wiretap application takes away the particularity with respect to devices. You would, in effect, be saying, I want to tap this person, and I definitely want to tap his phone, and his phone at the office, and this other phone that we know that he uses. But he probably uses lots of other phones. In fact, we know he uses lots of other phones. And rather than run back to you every time we discover another phone that he uses, we want a blank check so that as soon as we discover that he's using this phone, we can go ahead and tap it. Well, that is a huge change in wiretap power, and it's one that ordinary law enforcement did not have until 1986, even though it did have clear wiretap powers since 1968. And in 1986, when Title III gave the FBI and other ordinary law enforcement officials the power to do this, they had to state in the application that the suspect or the target of surveillance was actually trying to thwart ordinary surveillance before they could get a roving wiretap order. That was changed in 1998 so that they merely have to show that the effect of frustrating that kind of surveillance was going to occur. And so that shifts everything from what the target is doing or intends to do to really just technology itself. Because as we know, the convergence and innovation in telecommunications has just sort of naturally made it so that it's harder to pin someone down to a particular device. We're always moving from phones to another phones to pagers to whatever. It's just the nature of the technology that makes it harder. So that 1998 change has now been imported directly into the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And where they could never do roving wiretaps before, they can now. And what this means, for instance, is that if you have a foreign student at a university who is deemed to be an agent of a foreign power, and that person uses a payphone in the corner of his dormitory, they can tap that. And if they discover that he's using a public library terminal for internet access somewhere, well, they can slap a tap on that, and so on and so forth. They can follow the person around. And so even though the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is intended to target agents of foreign power, it can very easily end up capturing communications of U.S. persons who use the same facilities or devices that the so-called agent is using. And so whatever else you might have heard about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, do not be fooled into thinking that it only affects foreign persons. It reaches to any person that foreign people associate with, and that's usually plenty of us.
And that concludes this edition of Radio Free Cyberspace. For more information on the Patriot Act and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, visit our webpage at www.eff.org. We are a membership-based organization, and your help is needed now more than ever as we fight for freedom and liberty in cyberspace. Our web address again is www.eff.org. And that concludes this edition of Radio Free Cyberspace.